I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Are you in Fremantle today, Martin?
I'm on the road at the moment. I'm joining you from Sydney this time.
You can be anywhere in this geopolitical world, Martin. Really, everything old is new again. I'm thinking I'm back in the 1950s, just starting school and learning about schisms in political parties in Australia and communism taking over the world and the football team not performing. But Martin, there's news that President Xi is going to be meeting with President Putin and Kim Il-sung's son, Kim Il-jong, in China. I mean, it really does seem everything old is new again. What's happening there?
Well, I think that, North Korea is trying to use these opportunities to come in from the cold. They've typically never had that many friends, as you know. So I think there's an attempt to really try to develop some links. And also, their economy is really down in the dumps. And the two nations that they've typically had some economic relationship with have been Russia and China. And at one time or another, one or both of those countries have propped them up and kept them, with enough goods coming in and enough trade, etc. So it does make sense, I think, from their perspective.
When you get President Xi as the guy bringing everyone together, it really suggests he's the puppet master in the rest of the world apart from the United States.
That's a good observation. So, if you went back a few years, you'd think Putin probably would see himself at least as Xi's equal, and probably more important. But Putin's been under a lot of pressure with these Western sanctions, and the economy is not going so well. And really, it's propped up by a trade with China. So Xi is helping out Putin, and Xi obviously provides support for North Korea as well. So they really are. He is very well placed.
And we shouldn't forget that the North Koreans have been sending, I was going to use the word fodder, that would be inappropriate, infantry men and sending them to Russia to go and fight in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think that shows the leverage that I think your ranking here in those three is Xi, Putin, and then Kim Il-jun. So I think North Korea is dependent on Russia. Russia itself is dependent on China. North Korea is dependent on China. It makes sense for them to consolidate their relationship to a degree. I also think this is about Xi using that to leverage his standing internationally to show that he's the man bringing all this together. And I think that he's probably positioning himself as the person that the US might need to go to if they want to make progress with either Putin or with North Korea.
Well, I think I must renew my subscription to the Pyongyang English Language Times, Martin. Back in the mid-70s, a good client of mine who travelled the world doing business subscribed me to the Pyongyang Times, and suddenly this magazine newspaper arrives. I'm not sure if I learned a lot from it, but I must get back in touch and find out what's happening. But tell me, what was Richard Marles doing in Washington, D.C. the other day? I didn't know he was there. And then I learned it was all a bit of a, well, I'm not sure if it was a drama. It seemed a bit of a fizzle.
Well, this is a bit of a mystery. So it goes on a lightning tour to the US, and the US is not exactly next door, is it? It's a decent hike. And he's trumpeting, and you see pictures of him meeting with Vice President Vance and Defense Secretary Hegseth. Now, Australia's been under a bit of pressure from some publications around not having a close enough relationship with the US. So there's no doubt that the trip and the photos are designed to try and emphasize that. And I think there's some photos with Ambassador Rudd there as well, and he's trumpeted on his social media channels. But then we hear from Hegseth himself, who says, well, we didn't actually really have a meeting, it's a chance encounter. So what's really going on here? Is it just a PR stunt, Michael?
Well, it seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, Hegseth, we have to remember, is a sort of a fox anchor man who once served at some low level in the military and is now made him the Secretary for Defence.
Well, even if it was a chance encounter, I think it's not that healthy for Hegseth to be putting that out there, and so kind of diminishing, if you like, the standing of one of the US's allies. We have got a long relationship with them, So I think that there'll be some disquiet within the Australian government about that. And it probably does speak to how this administration is just not as interested in some of those diplomatic niceties as former administrations.
Well, as much as President Trump has admired Hegseth when he's standing in uniform, so to speak, maybe the left hand in Washington, D.C. doesn't really know what the right hand is doing.
There's been a lot of questions about Hegseth. I mean, he's stumbled at times when trying to answer key questions about his portfolio. He's obviously very, very loyal to Trump, says the right things in that respect. So Trump values loyalty above all other things. He's safe in that respect. But there's been a lot of ructions within his actual portfolio, and it's such a central one to the US.
Well, there's no doubt there will have been a bit of backslapping from the Americans on the Australian backs, probably including Ambassador Rudds to at the news that Australia expelled the Iranian ambassador. What was that all about, Martin? Are you surprised? Is there any build up to this?
I'm not surprised at all given what we are told from Australian intelligence services. This is a very serious matter. So the allegation is that Iran or Iranian security operatives actually launched attacks on a Jewish synagogue and a Jewish business. Given these attacks have been listed as terrorist attacks, it's one thing to have, a difficult relationship with a country. It's another thing as an arm of that country's official intelligence services to be launching an attack on Australian soil. So I'm not at all surprised that the ambassador got expelled. And I think the question has got to be, what other actions might be taken? I mean, that's about really at the top end of the spectrum in terms of behaviour against a foreign government, isn't it?
It is, and I think Australia are having to leave Turkey at the same time. So you have this amazing situation, probably not since the Petrov affair, everything old is new again, from the 50s, with the Russians spying and so on, trying to have their plants in Australia, where we won't have diplomatic relations directly between Australia and Iran. Not entirely a satisfactory state of affairs, but understandable given what we're being told.
I mean, if you go back to the Cold War, there was plenty of Soviet spies running around in Australia, and several of them were convicted, booted out, and things like that. But I can't even remember in that time the Soviets actually launching an attack on Australian soil. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary allegation.
No, the Russians were just trying to convert us all to Lenin Marx or something, and
Was
it's
more infiltration of various political parties, wasn't it? They were accused of.
of our brains, of our minds. But whilst all that was happening, Parliament was back in Canberra, Martin. What were they doing? Anything?
So look, I think that, I mean, often the first session's about, niceties, and there's all of the introductory proceedings, and you've got new MPs offering their first speeches and the like. There's been a couple of things. The government is focused on at the moment on delivering on election commitments, and they've promised a fairly narrow remit in that sense. But then they've got this economic roundtable that you and I have talked about in previous weeks. That's, I think, the big moving feast, though. That's the interesting piece. If they're going to do something more aggressive or substantial, that would be it. Of course, we've got the recognition of a Palestinian state, which is no small symbolic matter, which has occurred during that time. A lot of debates in and around, a lot of heat in foreign policy debates. If you want an example, just back on that Iranian issue. You had the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister, Mikhail Akash, lash the government for not taking action sooner. Then you had Andrew Hastie from the same party actually pipe up and say, well, we tried to get the Morrison government to do this, and they weren't interested either. So conflicting messages out of the Liberals on that. But there's been a fair bit of heat on several of these international matters.
It is funny to watch the politics in all of this, Martin. And of course, that whole business about Netanyahu and Israel complaining that the Australians were allowing anti-Semitism to build in deep, and we were sabotaging synagogues and other Jewish buildings and people in danger. And it turns out to be the Iranians. But Australian intelligence and the Australian responsible ministers have been sending not entirely silent messages about foreign country threats to Australia for some time, have they not?
The fella to watch is Tony Burke, who I think's been very out there and aggressive. I think he defended very strongly booting out the Iranian ambassador and had said that that was just not on. But he's been very strong on Netanyahu as well. So I think he sees himself as having a strong remit on social cohesion and a complete intolerance of people that are seeking to stoke division and discord in community.
Martin, Australian prime ministers can sort of hold office as prime minister for as long as people keep voting their party in and they keep making their party members happy, and as long as they stay alive and pretty much compos mentis. There's probably been a few along the way who've lost that standing, but you can be prime minister for three or four goes. What's the longest running term for a prime minister in the country?
Well, just talking in the Australian context,
Yes.
we had 17 straight years from 49 to 66 for Robert Menzies. That's the record. And you have to add a couple of years as well to his first term from 1939. So that gives him 18 years as PM. That's pretty extraordinary. He's by far our longest serving. And then you go to John Howard with 11 years as the second longest term. But there have been some prime ministers that have been in power for decades in other countries. Now, the tricky thing is you need to look at how open and free those electoral systems are at times. So there's a big spectrum for elections. There's the completely liberal, free, fair democracies, and there's the democracies that are not really democracies at all, and then there's plenty of systems somewhere in between.
Well, accepting that we're a liberal democracy, those sort of long years of service, I mean, you have to get yourself re-elected three or four times. I
We have
think,
short terms as well,
yeah.
which you point out. So 3 years is not a really long term before you have to face the electorate again.
Well, President Trump wants to come back for a third time. Is that possible?
It's highly unlikely. The Constitution says that you cannot be elected more than two times, and some of Trump's supporters and fan base, etc., have suggested that he could try some elaborate mechanism to get around that. The one that I heard was where someone else would actually be elected president on the Republican ticket. He might be officially elected vice president. That person resigns and he takes it on. So he wasn't actually elected. Now, I'm no constitutional lawyer. But I think it's quite unlikely it would be an extraordinary mechanism. You'd have to tell the American public, you're not electing me, but you are electing me. I find that hard to believe, but I've been surprised before.
Well, yes, and from memory, President Putin managed some sort of constitutional arrangement in Russia, didn't he?
So he was president for the maximum term. He arranged his mate Medvedev to take over for a term as president because it was around consecutive terms. He stood as prime minister, and then he came back in as president after that. But then he subsequently changed the constitution in Russia to remove fixed term or maximum terms, which he can do. I think it would be much harder in another place like America.
Well, I'm sure President Trump's having his people have a close look at the Putin playbook, amongst others. But I've also been thinking, Martin, the revolution in Russia back in 1917 was all about inequality. It was about the overlord. It was about the aristocracy, about the czars. It was about all the poor workers, the proletariat, who didn't get a look in. And things were meant to be improved under communism, and maybe for some they were. And we had versions of it right through the Iron Curtain. The question of inequality between classes, or capital and labour, or just between people in a workforce. I mean, wage inequality in Australia has been highlighted recently. I mean, there are people who get paid this much and the people who get paid that much. recent reports out. I mean, it's the sort of thing that should bring governments down if it gets really bad, shouldn't it?
I think it showed that inequality was increasing. That was the first thing. And it also said that what we've seen on some of the official figures probably doesn't represent the full reality there too. That's the figure's much worse than it looks. It isn't it is worth us understanding this and dissecting this, because Australia's always seen itself as a very egalitarian country. Now, we look at the US and we expect to see disparity there. We look at other countries and see extreme wealth and poverty, and we think that's not us. But I think that we are seeing poverty, and including poverty amongst actual full-time wage earners as well, coexist amongst whilst we see other salaries balloon. So it is it's worth us really understanding and trying to do something about this, because inequality manifests itself in all sorts of other negative outcomes for a community and society.
Well, I mean, let's try and just imagine what these sort of inequalities are. They're the CEOs of public companies who get paid and sometimes quite extraordinary amounts of money, and you compare it to people down the bottom. I mean, what sort of disparities are we seeing here, Martin?
Well, the report that you are mentioning, it's officially listed about seven times the average full salaries that CEOs on publicly listed companies earn. Actually, the real figure that was calculated in this report was about 103 times. And that's the part that's really disturbing. You're never going to get complete inequality, complete equality, unless you lived in a different system. But 103 times. And then we saw a comparison. We talked about the US. The US, I think, is about 269 times. So we're not as bad as that. Britain's 214. I mean, not as bad as those countries, but even so, I mean, that's a real issue. 103 times the average full-time salary.
I suppose the first thing you do when you look at these sort of problems is to recognise their issues, and you put out facts and stats, and people can contend over them and say, well, they're a bit misleading, or they're not detailed enough, and you need to understand them. But assuming there is that sort of disparity, do we need to worry about it? And if we do, what do you do about it? Do you adopt a Marxist-Leninist view of the world?
I think there's practical things that you can do. You can be asking boards to report on salaries more often. There might be ways in which you tie regulation to this area. You can certainly look to provide better services. And one of the important things around inequality is, if you've got good health, education, and other services, that makes a big difference. We're particularly poor with housing, for instance, housing being unaffordable for a lot of people. You could probably sustain a lower income if you make those services affordable, accessible and affordable. The other thing, obviously, Michael, and we've heard a lot of commentary over this, is the taxation system. So, what are we doing in that area to make sure that we have better equality?
Another interesting part of all of this, and Australia's still developing culturally, I suppose, is that men still seem to run all of the big institutions, the big private companies, the big listed companies. Women are there, but still they're still a small minority, aren't they?
It's about four out of five of the publicly listed companies have male CEOs, so there's still some way to go. You look at some of the other industries and areas, and they've been pushing for gender equality, and then you still see this glass ceiling that exists. I think some people in that sector would say, well, it's probably increased to 20% from 5% or 10% previously, but 20% is clearly not enough. It doesn't have to be 50-50, Michael, but you would have thought it gets a lot closer to 50-50 than what it is.
Well, I suppose the other thing is, and this just gets you back to grassroots, doesn't it? You look at the way our community works generally. We come back to education. In a country like this, using the egalitarian theory, every kid, whatever their social circumstances are, can, in theory, and sometimes it indeed happens, can become the prime minister, can rise to become the CEO of a large listed company. You want to provide those opportunities and make them real all the way down, so that education isn't a privilege that that people can stay healthy, and getting healthcare isn't a privilege for a chosen few. That still has to be our aim, doesn't
Yeah, we have very few formal blocks on opportunity in Australia. So there's no formal prohibition on people succeeding from whatever background. But we also know, and it's pretty evident, a lot of studies have shown this, is that there's plenty of informal barriers, such as the quality of education, the quality of health, the type of housing you live in, etc. That does make a material difference on whether you succeed. There's a lot of, I'll just give you one example. There's analysis out of schools that show that most students in a given school are within a certain band or median range for that performance of that school. So, and how does that, what does that mean? It means if you go to a really high performing school where people get 80 to 90, but 90 ATAR, maybe 90 ATAR, then you'll be within that median, most of the people. If you go to a school that gets 60 ATAR, then you're likely to be within that median band, most students. So there's a lot of educational outcomes that are still dictated by the postcode that you live in.
Martin, the other thing we've been hearing a lot about is intergenerational inequality. I still, in some ways, I don't mean to say this implausibly, I'm trying to get my head around it all, but I suppose it means you've got wealth locked up in those same sorts of families you're talking about, that we make a quick supposition that the 90 ATAR people versus the 60 ATAR people, as a broad generalisation, have parents who have got some established wealth locked away. Their kids are going to get it, where and that there's a growing phenomenon. So you've got this rich, poorer division in Australian society. That may be a bit simplistic, though.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this previously. This came up during the economic roundtable. You've got people of younger age that are typically struggling financially and finding it difficult to set themselves up sustainably. And then you've got this a much older demographic that are in a very comfortable situation and for whom the policy settings suit well. So we have to find a way to unpick that and provide younger people with greater security. I don't think anyone wants to see older people poor. There are still some pensioners and the like, but there's a lot of statistical analysis that will show this up.
Martin, one response, and every response gets its a quick set of critics, was for the federal government to say we'll bring down a 5% deposit on housing and loan arrangements to support that. Immediately criticised for saying, well, that means there's going to be more people out in the market. The price of housing will go up even more, and people be able to afford it even less. But you have to try these things, don't you?
Oh, I'm a bit of a critic of measures to expand demand in an already overheated housing market, Michael. I think the answer is more supply. It's not by stimulating demand. And many governments have tried throwing cash at first home buyers, etc. And all that happens is the house prices go up and it doesn't make a material difference.
So we have to keep building houses, Martin.
Yeah, I think that's there's a lot of discussion around that. And there's not one easy solution. But if you take a the attitude that everyone has to work hard to remove those barriers, and you've got to charge through some of those obstacles, then you'll start making some headway.
We'll come back to it, and in fact, watch the shipping news in the sort of the architecture and areas where. The tiny house movement, Martin, is not making a comeback, but it's being seriously talked about and acted upon, I think, around the country, but particularly here in Fremantle. Where you put down tiny houses, I'm not quite sure. You can put them in backyards, perhaps. You can try and create the equivalent of small development areas and create new urban complexes, I suppose. But the idea that everybody can get a house quickly with a tiny house, appeals to the imagination.
Well, I'll tell you, this is something that went through the local government in Fremantle some years ago, and I can't update you as to how this has fared, but they put through a change to local bylaws that permitted small granny flats in the back of people's gardens and houses. I think it went through with a bit of opposition. It would be interesting to see if that's made any difference locally. That was a few years ago now. It sounded quite innovative and interesting at the time, a bit out of the box. It's, I mean, I think all those things are worth trying at least and seeing if they can make a difference.
Martin, the other not quite geopolitical event is the state of football, AFL football in Australia. The Fremantle Dockers, not tomorrow night, but in a week's time on Saturday night, are playing the Gold Coast Suns, all these relatively young football teams. And Fremantle is struggling for success. They desperately want to win a Premiership Cup. The Gold Coast Suns are in the finals for the very first time. Pretty impressive looking team. They're having to fly to Fremantle to play Fremantle at night. Are you prepared to make any predictions?
I'm tipping the Dockers. I think they'll get over the line, and I think their form's been pretty good, Michael. I think it's something around 7 or 8 of the top 9 they've beaten during the season. So they've got good recent form, good form against the finalists. They're at home, and it's their first final in a few years. I think they'll be pumped and primed.
Well, on that very confident and happy note, which I'm sure our listeners will appreciate, was consciously intended to replace any discussion about Ukraine and Gaza this week. We'll cross our fingers, Martin, and not walk under any ladders and all of those other things. And I'll see you next Friday before the
Look
bid.
forward to it as always.